Stephen Wadsworth, we're here to talk about opera in general, and specifically you are in Columbus directing Benjamin Britten's The Turn of the Screw for Opera Columbus's, which opens officially this Friday night and repeats Sunday afternoon in the Southern Theater. I've only seen the piece once, and I've kind of been around, and I saw it in a church in my hometown in Lexington, Massachusetts, which was a sort of a anti-colonial era church, but it lended itself very well to the kind of creepiness of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me your experience with this piece and your views about Henry James and The Turn of the Screw.
Well, I first came to the piece through Benjamin Britten, the composer, whose work is, you know, justly famous and fascinating and always sort of always deals with moral ambiguities. Who's right, who's wrong, what really happened, what ought to have happened, and all the operas that he wrote leave us on the horns of a dilemma. So I had been interested for that reason, and I last did this piece as a director 30 years ago in Omaha, Nebraska, in a little festival that I ran there at Opera Omaha for a few years. The James book, I must have read when I was 18 because I found a paperback copy of it that said 1971 in it. So I did read it then, and then I reread it before the show I did 30 years ago, and I hadn't reread it since then. And aside from being just a terrific sort of psychological mystery and a creepy story, it also is, in Britten's hands, particularly, more so than in James's, it's a, it asks the question of whether what happens in the show is really happening or whether it's happening in the mind of the principal character.
The governess.
The governess.
And in the novel, the ghosts, Quint and Miss Jessel, have no lines.
Right.
They appear, and the way he sets up their appearances is quite frightening. One does jump out of one's seat. In the opera, they sing. They do have lines. Quint has some extensive lines, in fact. Do you think that that makes them different in characterization from the novel?
Well, inevitably it does. And inevitably, when you have a character on the stage with an actor playing that character, you're going to have a conversation about what this person, dead, alive, giant, you know, dwarf, god, human, whatever, in, you know, Ring of the Nibelung terms, whatever type of being is put out there, ultimately in the hands of an actor, has to become a human person. It has to operate on the according to the rules of being human. And so we think about in the opera what the ghosts need and what it feels like to be them, which in the James is not at all the case. They are silent visitors who occasionally appear, and the governess in the Henry James takes that where she takes that and tries to organize that, you know, phenomena experience into something rational. In the opera, they have passionate voices and passionate needs, and those are played out in a way that they aren't in the James. And that's a beautiful, strange sort of extrapolation of ghosthood, if you will. I mean, we find out about what it might like. We're forced to think about what it might be like to be a ghost and why ghosts are there. Ghosts come back, you know, conventional wisdom, because they have unfinished business. So what is that business? And what is their investment in it? Obviously, the stakes must be pretty high if they decided that they needed to stay around.
Two children, Miles and Flora, are in the care of a governess who has no proper name in the show. But we know that they had been cared for by two people who are now dead, who will come back. They terrify the governess. You mentioned, of course, ambiguity in Britten's operas. Do you think his music for this opera contributes to the ambiguity, or does he know what's going on?
No, I think it's in Britain's interest, and I think it's what fascinated him, the mysteries of being and the ironies of, sort of moral ironies of being alive in society and dealing with pressures of both private and public. I think these are things that were that weighed very heavily on him and which he wrote into everything he did. So the governess is definitely trying to figure out what's real, and she is our sort of official guide. We see through her eyes, principally. She's in all of the scenes. No other characters are in all of the scenes. So she takes us through, and we try to work out with her what the real reality is. The truth is that there are, because the ghosts are embodied and they sing with passion and they have beautiful, strange music, that they become very real to us. They are actually on the stage and they are actually singing. So again, in the theater, it's a great leveler of the playing field. We're not allowed to think of them as just ghosts. I have seen productions where they have been sort of completely relegated to ghosthood in a way, and there isn't any ambiguity. But that doesn't seem to me what Britain was interested in at all. So here they're rather more human.
I'm fascinated when the young boy Miles is referred to as being bad. Has he ever been bad? And when you first hear that, you might think, do they mean bad, naughty, like a little boy would misbehave? Mm-hmm. What do you think bad means in this context?
Well, I think it means everything from a naughty boy to evil, or to doing harm in a deep way. That he sings a little song based on the Latin noun malum. Malo, malo, he says, which is, and also malo, is a word of its own. It means both apple in its secondary meaning, and in its primary meaning, it means any form of disruption, evil, harm, damage, you know, wrongdoing, all of these things. So it has a kind of, it becomes quite epic in the mind of the governess, who is trying to determine whether these kids are somehow in league with or have ongoing relationships with the ghosts. It's clear that when the ghosts were alive, they, at least Quint and the little boy, there was some kind of inappropriate, what we would call an inappropriate relationship there. And of course, these were the sort of only parent figures that these kids have. In the Henry James, we find out that they were parentless, that they're, when they were very young, and in England, their parents died in Inja, where they'd been sent off for the empire. So these people were very close to them, Miss Jessel and Quint, who took care of them. Miss Jessel and Quint got into a romantic, some kind of romantic or sexual attachment, which seems strongly implied that Miss Jessel got pregnant, that she couldn't deal with that, being a well-born young woman in a governess position, and that she took her own life, presumably by jumping into the lake next to which she appears in the opera. So there's hinted at history there, which is in itself ambiguous. You don't get, no one comes out and says, okay, so this is what happened. Mrs. Gross, the housekeeper, the sixth character, does tell the governess that there was a person called Quint, that he had his will with everyone morning and night, including Miss Jessel and with the little boy. That's all you hear, and the for certain. And the rest of it is surmise. So we're caught in this. The piece makes us need to know more than it ever really lets us know, and so it keeps us in a constant state of unnerved sort of wonderment. We're like what is this going to be? Where is this going to go?
It's a small orchestra. What is it, 14 musicians?
I think 13. Well, it's 13. It's set for 13, but the percussion part was written, is quite virtuosic, especially in terms of changing instruments. So we have two percussionists splitting that notoriously difficult and number of instruments and all of it. So I think that we have 14 in the pit, I believe. I could be wrong about that.
Opera Columbus has begun a relationship with the Juilliard School, which Peggy Criadaia, our artistic director, is an alumna, with a master's program, an artist diploma program in opera studies, which I believe you have charge of.
That's right.
What is the relationship and how's it working?
Well, it is exclusively with the artist diploma, with the group of, my group of eight, the postgrad, the advanced. These are people who now, I've been there now, this is my 10th year at, as a regular faculty person at Juilliard running this program. And we've changed it a lot over the years, and as a result of a variety of initiatives, including the inclusion of the master's students in our casting pool, the level of the master's students has gone up incredibly, to an incredibly high level, and ditto in my program. We take people, only people that we believe are have a serious career possibilities, and now much more often they do go off into active careers, mostly starting in Europe, as it happens. That's because in the last 10 years so many opera jobs have dried up in or gone away in North America due to the recession 2008. In any case, the agreement that Peggy and I sort of cobbled together is that she offers a leading role to every member of my group, either in the 2 years of the program at Juilliard or in ensuing years. So it's a sort of, it can be open, and it's open and flexible. This year, in the turn of the screw, is the first time that we've had two people come in. They are both second years at Juilliard now. We also have in the cast of Turn of the Screw Miles Mikkonen, a tenor who appeared last year as a second-year Juilliard ADOS person in The Abduction from the Seraglio here, and he has come back. So now he's a grad. He's a former student. But
yes, he was James Bond last year, and now he's a ghost with wonderful lines and great music, I add.
Amazing.
So this is not your mother's La Boheme. This is a different kind of operatic experience, but a very potent one. And it is something that you are bringing to Opera Columbus Friday night and Sunday afternoon in the Southern Theater. Benjamin Britten's The Turn of the Screw. Stephen Wadsworth, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.